Good evening and welcome to this evening's programme talk of the Staple Inn Actuarial Society. My name is Natanya Olofsa and I'm the Honorary Secretary for SIAS.
Sorry, can you speak up? It's my
Okay. Technical issues. Tell me when it's working. Okay. Great. So, welcome everyone to tonight's talk. Before I introduce tonight's talk, I have a couple of notices about upcoming SIAS events. Our next program event will be our Jubilee Lecture on Tuesday, the 8th of October. Our SIAS AGM will take place at 5:45 p.m., followed by a talk on a monetary approach to economics by the well-known economist and author Steve Keen. Further details and online registration for this event are available on SIAS's website, and we will also be running a live webinar to cater to those of you who can't attend in person, so please indicate your preference to attend in person or online when registering. Our annual SIAS welcome drinks will take place on Tuesday the 15th of October at 6 p.m. and further details and tickets for this event are available on our website. This year, SIAS is hosting its 82nd annual dinner at the Ballroom South Bank on Friday the 22nd of November. Again, further details can be found on the SIAS website. Next, a few standard notices about tonight's event. Tonight's event is hosted by SIAS. We do encourage those of you that aren't currently SIAS members to join, and further details can be found on the SIAS website. There is an attendance sheet in the smaller room just outside the hall, so if you didn't sign this on your way in, don't forget to sign it on your way out. Attendance at these talks does not get automatically added to your CPD record, so please remember to update your CPD in the usual way. And then we're eager for our talks to run as smoothly and effectively as possible and would be delighted to hear any feedback you have. We will email you a short online survey after the talk. Please take a minute or two to complete this. We need your feedback to create the best possible experience for our members. And then if the fire alarm sounds, it's not a test, please exit using the fire exits at the back of the hall. And then finally, a reminder to switch your mobile phones to silent. Tonight's talk will last around 1 hour and be followed by a Q&A with the speakers. If you have a question, please raise your hand and a microphone will be brought to you. We value everyone's contribution at these talks, so there's a bottle of champagne on offer for the best contribution to the discussion by a student member of the IFOA and another for the best contribution from any fellow of the IFOA. So please clearly state your name and which of these categories you fall into before you ask your questions this evening. Following the meeting, there will be sandwiches and networking drinks in the smaller room just outside the hallway, so please do join us for that. And then back to tonight's talk. Carol Story is an actuary in PwC's Sustainability and Climate Change team, specialising in financial services. That includes pensions, asset management, insurance, and banking. Carol is passionate about helping clients manage risks and opportunities related to climate change and other sustainability issues. She is chair of the IFOA's Climate Change Working Party, which published an introductory guide on climate change for actuaries earlier this year, and also a member of the IFOA's Resource and Environment Research and CPD Subcommittee. Welcome. And then we've got Kim Bull, who is a manager in PwC's Sustainability and Climate Change team with 7 years of consulting experience. She works with clients in a range of sectors to assess environmental, social, and economic impacts, risks, and opportunities. And then last but not least, we've got Samir Karnik, who has 8 years of expertise across sustainability, including ESG, climate change mitigation and adaptation, carbon management, sustainability reporting and assurance, and responsible finance. He is currently on secondment in London from PwC India. On that note, over to you, Carol.
Okay, thank you. And thank you, everyone, for joining us tonight. So today is, am I a bit too loud? Today is an introductory presentation about climate change, and we are aiming to get you from climate zero to climate hero. And we're going to do this in three ways. First of all, we're going to tell you 10 things that we think you should know about climate change. Then we're going to help you talk about it and talk through some of the communication issues that come up when you're talking about climate change. And finally, we're going to talk about why it's becoming much more relevant for actuaries and the kind of actions that you may be having to take in the future.
Right. So, to start off the session... So to start off the session today, we'd like to start with a little quiz. So what we'd like you to do is to get into groups of two or three people and to come up with a unique, distinct name for yourself. What we want to do with the quiz is to A, get all our minds focused on climate change and the topic we're here to discuss today. But what it will also do is introduce you to the topics and themes that we're going to cover in the next hour. And throughout the next hour, we will also explore the answers to all of these questions. To motivate you, we've got some prizes. So the top two teams that will win the quiz, they can choose some books that we've got here at the front. So you can come after the presentation later and pick your book. So if I can ask you all to get into groups of two or three people, please. Don't be shy. Maybe introduce yourself as well. Okay. So if one of you, so not all of you, but if one of you could take out their phone and type in this into your browser, so you're going to work together as a team and submit one answer as a team. So you just need one phone for each team.
Recommend.
Okay, and you need to type in your group name as well. Try to be as creative as you like to be. Okay, so there's going to be 10 questions we're going through, but the first, so essentially 11 questions. The first question is just a test question to get you all comfortable with the app, and then we have 10 questions. It's not just about getting the right answer, but also how quick you are. So the points you get and the person that will win needs to provide the right answers the quickest. So if I can ask to start the presentation.
Just before we start, actually, has everyone managed to get online to the...
Oh, one slide. Sorry, that's a good shout. Yeah.
Can we just get the link back up, please, ABC?
I think it says it at the bottom, doesn't it?
There. Yeah. Kim, just say you'll give them an extra 10 seconds.
Yeah. Was it just one person?
Yeah. Are we all good now?
Anyone else still struggling, or we're okay to go? Okay, we're good to go.
Okay.
Okay, who won the 2018 FIFA World Cup? Hopefully still fresh on your mind. Okay, so we're now starting our quiz. The points will count now.
Quite quick now, isn't it?
Yeah. We've got 20 seconds for each question. Getting a bit more technical now.
So far, so good.
I think it's the right. Okay, time's up. Next question. We're halfway through the questions now. Okay, we're looking for the country that is not a member of the B20 economy. Okay, getting a bit more difficult, the questions now. Okay, two more questions left. Maybe getting a bit easier now. Okay, final question. Fantastic. That was our trivia game. How was that? I hope that's been fun to do, but yeah, we'll go through some of the answers. So, Carol, if I can ask you to show the results. Fantastic. So we've got the green actuaries and almost over. Who won the game? Where are you in the room?
Who are the green actuaries?
Oh.
Over there?
Green actuaries and almost over? Okay, in the back. Fantastic, congratulations.
The top three.
And front row. Yeah. That's actually a chair. Oh,
I
see where the name came
from.
Fantastic, so we've got three winners. If you all come after the presentation and pick from our selection of books as your prize. Fantastic.
Okay, AV team, can we get back to the presentation, please?
Okay, so you've had a go at the quiz, and now we're going to go through 10 things that we think you should know about climate change. And as we go along, we will reveal the answers to those quiz questions. So, Samir, here you go.
So, the science that underpins climate change is fairly robust. Most scientists agree on the scientific basis of climate change. There are few on the fringe that like to argue otherwise. I question where they get their funding from, perhaps from the fossil fuel industry, I don't know. The greenhouse effect has been known since the late 19th century. Data collected from sort of 1976 onwards on carbon emissions has made it clear that human beings are having an impact, and the primary cause is the burning of fossil fuels. Dr. James Hansen, who's a notable climate scientist, and he was the former head of NASA's Goddard Space Institute for Space Studies, testified before the Congress and warned the world. He kind of rang the alarm bell of the fact that human-induced climate change would have damaging effects. So in fact, the science is strong. Climate scientists have been warning us about climate change for a long time. But perhaps very little has been done to mitigate or to address this issue yet, and there's a lot that we need to do going forward. I think this little cartoon here sums it up fairly well. The scientists have been talking about climate change on and on and on. Who's really listening? If you'd like to know a bit more about sort of the history of climate science and how that's progressed over the years, there's a great article in the New York Times called Losing Earth, the decade we almost stopped climate change. Now, we're moving into uncharted territory, and mankind has never been here before. The CO2 in the atmosphere currently today is more than at any point in at least the past 800,000 years. Believe that or not. We'll look at a short video on the Keeling curve, and the video kind of compares the rise in emissions from the Industrial Revolution up until today with the previous epochs in Earth's history, and you'll see a drastic kind of a sharp increase that is quite shocking, actually. Carbon dioxide is not the only greenhouse gas emission we really need to worry about. There are many more greenhouse gases that are far more powerful than carbon dioxide. Livestock emit methane, and in one of the quiz questions was around this, and it makes up about sort of 15% of global greenhouse gases. Now, methane is 30 times more powerful than carbon dioxide. Which means one ton of methane would be equivalent to 30 tons of carbon dioxide in terms of its warming potential. Some of the other greenhouse gases, nitrous oxide, which is emitted from fertilizer use, has about a greenhouse warming potential of something between sort of 250 to 280. And the F gases, which are used in refrigeration and insulation as well, they have a far higher greenhouse warming potential, some of which go beyond from 1,500 upwards. So I think the point here is we do need to address a wide range of emissions that are emitted through a wide range of different sort of activities that we conduct. And for more information on this, you can go to climatewatchdata.org that has sort of the spread of historical emissions and divided by sectors and countries.
Okay. We're breaking all sorts of environmental records at the moment. If the video plays, it just shows you how over time, fairly recently, the atmosphere from these greenhouse gas emissions has been warming up. We are now in the middle of what is believed to be the 10 warmest years since we started recording temperatures in 1850. We have now recorded the hottest July on record. In Cambridge, we measured about 38 degrees, and that was made 20 times more likely because of climate change. That was also in your quiz, one of the questions, the answer being 20 times. More likely. Go back to the slide. Essentially, this statistic is coming from an attribution study, and as we will do throughout all the slides, we share with you some of the references where we've got some of this data from, so you can in your own time look at it if you want to find more information about it. And yes, the science is very clear. There's a lot of consensus around climate change and the impact of climate change, and NASA and the IPCC are really good sources if you want to read a bit more about these impacts. We're essentially now living in the epoch of the Anthropocene, believed to have started in about 1950, when really world population started to accelerate. And with that acceleration of world population, we also start, well, our need for resources had increased, our need for water, our need for new technologies, our need for paper, and so on. So all these graphs you see on the right-hand side show how that demand has accelerated fairly recently. And all of that demand puts pressures on our Earth's resources, which very similarly, at a similar rate, have increased over time. So you see that those green graphs on the right-hand side show how carbon dioxide has increased, how our deforestation is increasing, and so on. And that is also really having an impact on biodiversity. I think now every day 200 species are being extinct. And we also had a question in the quiz about the first mammal that got extinct. And I have to read the answer. It was answer A, Bramble K. Malomi, which I wasn't aware of. Do you know what type of mammal it is? No. If in doubt, go for the obscure sunny one. It's a rodent, actually, that became extinct. Every year we look at the, our annual budget of resources that we have available from Earth, and we look into at what point during the year have we exhausted all our annual budget. And this year, that was July 29th, you may have heard of Earth Overshoot Day. To put that into perspective, in 1999, Overshoot Day was on September 29th, so we're really kind of creeping forward within the year when we're exhausting all our resources.
Okay, thank you. So what does that actually mean for financial professionals? Well, climate change poses serious financial risks, and we're already seeing them materialise. And we put these risks into three buckets. The first of these is what you'd commonly associate with climate change, physical risks. So these are risks from extreme weather events like hurricanes, flooding, wildfires. They cause disruption to services, they cause damage to property, but they often include some longer term effects, changing seasons which can change crop yields. But there's another important risk for all financial professionals and especially actuaries to consider, and this is transition risk. So this is the risks that come about the disruption from trying to build a much lower carbon world. So these are risks posed by new pieces of regulation. These are changing in consumer preferences and habits. So my very first job was at Greggs. They have now a vegan sausage roll. Actually, that's an example of someone taking advantage of a transition opportunity. So they are kind of adapting their business and thriving and selling more pork sausages because of it. But that change in consumer habits to veganism, that is a transitional risk. And also technology risk. So you may have heard a stat that actually electric cars and vehicles are going to be cheaper than petrol alternatives by mid-2020s. So what does that mean if you're a car manufacturer or a petrol station and that's where you get your revenues from? Now, there's one more bucket. It's sometimes put it under transition risk, but I think it's really important to kind of bring it out and give it a little bit more attention. And that's liability risks. Now, litigation against or organizations that are emitting, kind of polluting our environment is going up. There's an exponential increase in climate change litigation. And it's often directed at kind of trustees, directors, businesses, and if you're an insurance company, you may provide professional indemnity insurance, you may provide other sorts of directors' insurance. So this is really relevant. You may end up finding there are more claims because of a company has not been seriously considering climate risks. And if you want to find out more about climate risks, the TCFD, which is the Task Force of Climate-Related Financial Disclosures, and you'll hear about that quite a lot through this presentation, has a great list of the different risks and some financial impacts and examples associated with them. So please do kind of check that out later. Another thing that I thought was really important to flag was that the poorest countries are paying twice, maybe three or four times more for climate change. And we had a question there around which country is not the member of the V20. Just to let you know what the V20 is. The V20 is a kind of cooperative of countries and economies that are very vulnerable to climate change. And you'll see that India is not a V20 country. The other thing you should know about the V20 is there are 48 countries in it, not 20. And I think that's to do with they're trying to kind of be an alternative to the G20. But these countries have three things in common. First of all, they're all very vulnerable to climate change. Now, that could be because they are in very hot regions with desertification. It could be that they are a low-lying island which is going to be submerged in future years. Or they're kind of on the path of hurricanes and cyclones each year. The second thing is they're not very mature or kind of established economies. And this has a few implications for their people. One is that they don't tend to have any insurance to protect them, or as much insurance to protect them against kind of disruption and damage due to climate change. But it can be quite difficult to access the capital to adapt their economies to climate change. I just want to flag a recent study by SOAS. They've actually found that climate change is making it even more expensive for these countries to borrow money. The third thing that they have in common is they are not mass polluters. So they are not the countries that cause most climate change. That's, you know, the UK is up there in the top 10, the US, it's now some of the larger countries like China as well. They are not heavily polluting. So they are suffering the most from climate change, but they have the least to do to do with it in that sense.
Since the Industrial Revolution, global average temperatures have increased by 1 degree Celsius. Now, that might seem extremely small, but we're already facing a lot of the effects of that. And you'd have read in the newspapers every other day there's a study that links various sort of extreme weather-related events to climate change. Corals are extremely sensitive to a rise in ocean temperatures. And a small rise in the temperature could lead to a bleaching event. Over the last couple of years, we've had a range of bleaching events, including a mass bleaching event at the Great Barrier Reef. Now, the difference between 1.5 degrees and a 2-degree world has implications for the survival of the Great Barrier Reef. In a 2-degree world, perhaps the Great Barrier Reef would be no more and the corals would die. In a 2-degree world and beyond, with a bit of sea level rise, many of those small island nations on the list of V20, things, places like Vanuatu, Tuvalu, may not exist on the world map, which reinforces the need for us to raise our ambitions and try and meet the 1.5 degree target that's set by the Paris Climate Convention. For more information on this, you can visit the IPCC. They have a technical report on this that actually talks about the various impacts from 1.5 degrees to 2 degrees or a 4-degree world.
So governments are also starting to think about what is their role in addressing carbon emissions and what they can do. In the UK, we have set our target to be net zero by 2050. That was one of the questions. So 2050 was the answer there. Essentially, we've been measuring carbon emissions since the 1990s, and we have accomplished some significant reductions in carbon emissions. So in 2018, we've been 44% below the 1919 levels in our carbon emissions. The majority of carbon emissions come from the generation as well as the consumption of energy. That includes kind of transport, manufacturing, our goods, and so on. So while we're making some progress, it's still very challenging to be net zero by 2050. And the government has set out its plan and said how it wants to accomplish it within the different sectors that are contributing to the greenhouse gas emissions. But it's also been criticized for not being challenging enough to actually accomplish that. Something to be said for very ambitious targets, though, is that when you set yourself a very ambitious target, you also give room for innovation and new technologies to try to accomplish it. So maybe we don't have all the answers right now, but by giving some space and resources to innovation, we may find the answers to get closer to that target. And again, some resources, the Climate Change Committee, who is advising the government on, measuring carbon emissions, but also how it can address that, is a really good resource to find out a bit more about the specific targets and the specific measures that the UK has set out.
Okay, and our kind of final top 10 thing that you need to know is, actually, we need to act now. Climate or greenhouse gas emissions are actually rising. They have kind of plateaued in previous years, but they are going back up. And at current rates, we are going to reach that 1.5 degree kind of target in perhaps as little as 11 or 12 years. There are some really nice resources to visualize how much kind of carbon budget, how much fuel and fossils we can burn in the next few years. And at the moment, estimates are between about 4 or 8 years. So in 4 to 8 years, we really need to have got our emissions to basically net zero, which is when you think about those transition risks and what needs to happen, that's a short amount of time for a huge amount of change. Right, so just before we move on to the next section, are there any kind of thoughts, comments, or questions on what we've just kind of covered? Okay, yes. Patrick. Sorry, I sprung this upon you, AV people.
Can you ask a question? Can you repeat it?
Yeah, we can always repeat.
Okay, it's working now. Thank you very much for that interesting quiz and information. On the graph where you were showing about what needs to happen for 2050, if you just go back to that picture, I was rather struck by the bar on the right-hand side of each of those bars, which I think is aviation. Mm-hmm. So if I'm reading this right, between 1990 and 2017, mm-hmm. aviation's got a good deal bigger, and it's still going to be pretty chunky by 2050. That seems to me to be a quite plausible future. We certainly are seem to be intending to fly a lot more planes, but really unrealistic if we're going to try and get to net zero. So at some point, it seems to me, if we really are committed to getting to net zero, we'll have to fly a good deal less. Would you agree with that?
Yes, I do. I think generally this kind of strategy is acknowledging that we live in a world where goods are being transported by air, people are being transported by air. But actually it needs a lot of personal changes as well if we want to accomplish that. I think half of the emissions, to reduce half of the emissions, it relies on people making actual changes. So it's not just about being more efficient or producing energy more efficiently or whatnot, but it's also really to cut down on consumption as well, and that needs to happen. But I think those are perhaps conservative. But this comes back to those challenging measures that need to be in place to actually drive the change and move towards net zero.
The lady over there. I can do this. Right.
Hi. Just on that slide again. I know that sometimes when people look at net zero emission, they're not necessarily actually reflecting some of the exports. So I think one of the reasons why we're actually getting nearer net zero is because we've been exporting a lot of like our manufacturing that we used to previously do here overseas. And I was wondering whether, is that taken into account in that metric, for example, or do you know any kind of good sources of like places where they are collecting that kind of data? Because I know there's a lot that don't.
In terms of resources, the starting point probably is the Committee for Climate Change website, actually, because they have quite... I mean, we can revisit this actually after, but they have really thorough analysis of how we're going, what it takes to achieve net zero, what it means in terms of exports, and even offsetting, because actually there is amount of kind of, you can plant forests, for example, to kind of suck in some of that carbon as well. Yeah, we'll take two more questions, and then we'll move on to the next section with you. So, I think there's a lady there, then you go ahead.
Does that work? Yeah, so I'm just a little bit surprised that we haven't been talking about technology. So something that I was aware of the question at the front was there is a lot of research going into electric-powered aircraft, and certainly in technology in terms of what people could do to the atmosphere to reduce the impact.
That is an interesting point, because some of the pathways that have shown us how we would get to a kind of 1.5 degree world, they do rely on new technologies like carbon capture technologies. I think there is a bit of a debate about whether technology will be ready in the time that we need it to be. So yes, it's actually really important, but I don't think everyone, especially climate scientists, aren't betting on that. Yeah, of course you can.
I think we need to think about some of the risks associated with the technologies that are being investigated at the moment. So I know there's groups in America who are thinking about throwing sulfur dioxide up into the atmosphere in order to cool the planet and it be going around the stratosphere for a period of time. There would be huge complications for our climate as a result of that, but it would be felt more in some countries than others, and that would put financial burden on certain countries as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And there is... some of these technologies could be quite scary, so you've got to think about the downside of what that means as well. And I guess that would come under some of these kind of transition risks. When you think about it, you've got to think about, is that technology going to fail? Is that going to come up with its own new kind of mitigation risk, for example? So, yeah, really, really good point. And I think there's a gentleman at the front here who would like to make a comment.
I wonder if you could... to talk a little about international issues. So you're focused here on UK household. I don't know what proportion that is of global emissions, but it's commonly quoted the Chinese are building a new coal-fired power station every week. The Americans seem very keen on developing coal. So we feel even if we could achieve these sorts of targets, it feels like we're in danger of patting ourselves on the back for doing good things in the UK while the rest of the world goes in the opposite direction.
Do you want to have a go?
So the perspective from India that the government keeps putting forward is sort of the issue of climate justice and compensation, where a lot of the developed economies have emitted quite a bit over in the past, and some of the developing nations haven't had a carbon budget to develop, which builds a case for some form of compensation. And there have been a lot of discussions of sort of various funds investing in places like India and China to help the country kind of move towards a cleaner path. But many of those commitments haven't been made good of. Despite that, I think we're in a world where a lot of the governments, especially sort of India, is starting to realize that the low-carbon future is the only future. And while we will perhaps still rely on coal, there aren't any plans to establish any new coal-fired plants in the country. And there was a target of about, I think it was 175 gigawatts for renewable energy. 2 years ago, they bumped that target up to somewhere close to 235. So they are kind of ramping up their emission, the ambition over time. And I think it's also sort of a connected world, right? So investors in the West will start demanding cleaner investments in countries like India. And perhaps that will encourage the system there to move towards a cleaner future.
I think this kind of builds on that. The case in the US, actually, we know that Donald Trump's agenda is very kind of, oh, climate change does not exist, and let's dig and let's mine and let's release loads of fossil fuels. But the reality is, cities kind of see the case. There are cities that are very worried about climate change, and like New York is going to be impacted by flooding. California is hugely impacted by wildfires. So those individual states and cities are still able to act in an American system. And also, some of the technology just makes really good sense. So why would you not want a clean way of releasing energy into the world that where you don't have to rely on kind of international politics and fluctuations? And so some of the things will make some sort of sense anyway. But yeah, I think the international, even if we act and Europe acts and a few others, that will still have an impact on climate change, and every little counts. The higher it goes, the worse it gets. Okay, one more question and we will have to move on.
Stuart Hicks, a fellow. You've said a lot here about carbon dioxide, but earlier on you said carbon dioxide was actually relatively minor compared with sulfur dioxide or methane or indeed the refrigeration gases. So have we got targets for all of those as well?
Okay, so just to kind of clarify that point, if that's all right, do you want to do that? So actually, carbon dioxide is less powerful. So its kind of heating effect is less powerful, but there's way, way much more of it. So actually, it's still the biggest issue, but after that, methane is the next biggest. So just to kind of clarify. But you're right, there is argument to look more closely at those targets, or like to have targets and greater awareness of the impact of refrigeration. Just to kind of raise this, that's a huge issue, because as the world gets warmer, we're going to need more air conditioning, and that is itself a kind of negative loop. So that's a really good point. Okay, we are now going to move on to how to get your point across. So I think we've got a poll.
Yes, if you can log on to the link that's up on the screen.
I think we can change this as well. Give people 30 seconds to get the link, and then we'll switch.
And give us a different one now than we had earlier.
Okay. Yeah, different code. And I think anyone with your phone out, you can have a go.
Anyone not on the link? Okay, I think we're ready to go.
Okay. So this one is not timed, you'll be pleased to know.
So here's the question. Which of the following reactions do you think is the biggest barrier to getting people to act on the climate change? Denial, uncertainty, indifference, or fear?
There is no right or wrong. This is just based on your view.
that's not, I've got to figure that out.
Okay, I will show the results. Okay, that is really interesting. So actually, it's not denial, it's not uncertainty, but the biggest barrier that kind of you guys think is indifference, lack of engagement. I wonder if anyone in the audience has any experience of having a conversation about climate change and coming across any of these reactions. We'll take one, just for time reasons. At the back there.
Can I just give the example of pension fund trustees saying that in relation to managing the stewardship of their assets, it's not their problem, their problem's just risk and return, doesn't matter, there's no planet to retire into.
And when you're faced with that, what's your reaction been?
I just tell them that, you know, by the time their last pensioner, you know, looks to pay pension, they won't be able to pay it because they are looking at the risk, more than 1 in 20 risk, of financial system collapse.
Yeah.
So one, it's there, and second, actually now it is their problem because the regulators have made it so. But actually, I prefer to do it in context of financial risk. This is a real risk to their fund, and also the one that can crystallise with it, you know, any moment now, but certainly within the next 5 years when we come to the stock take in 2025.
Okay, can we go back to our presentation now? Okay, so fortunately, you won't come across denial in climate change's existence very often. And actually, you guys don't think it's the biggest barrier, and it probably isn't the biggest barrier or hurdle you're going to face in this conversation. But it does happen, and I have been in meetings with kind of senior investment professionals in an insurance company where kind of one of them has been like, climate change, it's not a real thing, it doesn't matter. And when that actually happens to you, that can completely floor you. Like, what are you going to say to that? You're trying to sell to them, you're trying to impress them, and they just have poo-pooed everything you've just said. Now, and I'm kind of interested in the audience's views on this, but there are two ways you can do that. One is you can challenge them. So you can kind of throw the scientific consensus at them. You can tell them, actually, Mark Carney thinks it's an issue, so why don't you? You can throw lots of information. But if they've already decided that they don't believe in the science, they don't believe in what kind of regulators and politicians are saying, they don't believe the media, they don't believe their children, it's going to be hard to persuade them in that situation. So what I think that does work is actually moving the conversation on to transition risk. Because even if you don't believe in man-made, or let's say human-made climate change, actually, you might still be able to see with your own eyes that transition risk is an issue. There is new regulation coming in. You can see the technologies emerging. You know that there are kind of new consumer trends. And actually, especially to perhaps someone working in investment, that would make some sort of sense. You're talking about disruption. Now, that's worked for me. Just anyone in the audience that's dealt with that situation before have anything to share? It's okay if you don't. Oh, yes, we have one man over there at the back.
I think it's interesting you've used that. I mean, it's not in regard to this, but the number of times over the consultancy I've done over 30 years, and you keep saying you ought to do this, you ought to do this, and then the regulator says you've got to do this, that's when people change.
Yes, yeah. And that, in terms of kind of what we see in the interest from clients, it definitely has picked up after the regulator kind of takes an interest. Yeah. Just a little bit more about the different reactions you can get to climate change. Per Esten Stoeckner has a nice TED talk around just that topic. It's something that you could perhaps use more in a personal situation, but you can apply some of those to kind of your work situation as well. I'm not going to go into handling uncertainty in too much detail. But when in the earlier days, I did hear a lot of, ooh, it's too uncertain to act. Now, hopefully as actuaries, we kind of deal with uncertainty quite a lot, and we are comfortable with this. But there is this great research, a piece of research from the University of Bristol called the Uncertainty Handbook, and it has several ways that you can kind of help manage conversations where you think the uncertainty around climate change is could be an issue. It's very user-friendly, it's very quick. The one that you may have seen a lot in terms of the way scientists now talk about climate change is Principle 7. They start to talk about when these things are going to happen, not if these things are going to happen. And you saw that earlier in the way that they talk about the 1.5 degree world. It's happening between these two time periods. That's quite a useful way.
We often find that visuals can be really powerful as well when you're talking about climate change and can really underpin the message that you're trying to bring across. Visuals really help us make sense of the world and, kind of get emotions out of us as well. And the climate visuals is a really good resource if you're looking for climate change-related pictures that can help create your story as well. And they've done quite a bit of research about how people are reacting to different types of imagery, and they've come out with the 7 principles of visual climate change communication. 2 of them I just want to briefly touch upon. One being be careful with protest imagery. That's something that they found really can kind of divide people. So often in the press we see environmental activism portrayed by protesters out on the street, Extinction Rebellion more recently, and that can be perceived by people as quite aggressive, which they may not want to be associated with when they talk about environmental activism. But there are other stories and other imagery that can also talk about protests, but that are a bit more softer or a bit more gentler and maybe evoke different types of emotions. Something else that's really important is understanding your audience. So who are you talking to? If you're speaking to people who are consider themselves as innovators or really interested in new technologies, then you can really talk about the technology angle, how we're addressing climate change and trying to reduce our carbon emissions. So here being a picture with Tesla, for example. So now I'd like to show you a series of pictures that address climate change or talk about the impacts of climate change. And I'd really just like to take a moment to see how does that sit with you, what kind of emotions do you get, what kind of reactions do you have, and maybe afterwards we can, maybe someone would like to share their initial reaction. So I'll just take you through a couple of headlines and pictures. And now maybe taking a bit of a different angle. Maybe someone wants to share what kind of strikes them and what their kind of initial reactions were looking at the first set of pictures and maybe the second set of pictures. Does anyone like to share? I think it's, in the back.
I suppose we see these images every day, so I think we're immune, I'm afraid. My reaction is that I know I should have more of a reaction, but I'm just see it every day.
Hmm. Recently seen more of it, or?
Have I seen more of it? Do I open articles on climate change every day? No. Do I, if I see something which I think is different, do I open it? Yes. But if I see, we all know what's going on over in Westminster tonight. I'll read one article. I'm not going to read the 43 and the Brexit terminology on BBC for the 43rd time that is linked on every single BBC thing. If I don't know what Brexit is now, I shouldn't be reading it. But more seriously, if I keep seeing 1.5, 1.5, 1.5, I ain't going to open every article.
So what is an example of something different that you recently saw, if there has been anything.
The aviation one, I mean, you talked about the different planes. I mean, I didn't talk about that, but I'd be interested to see per passenger, because I know that obviously Dreamliners use a lot less than 747s, and there was actually an article that my wife pointed out in the Waitrose newspaper about a plane and doing something yourself to Boston on the 31st of October, and the first plane is a Dreamliner and the second one is a 747. Mm-hmm. And the reason my wife pointed it out is that we're going to Boston on the 31st of October, and unfortunately we're on the 747. And I didn't look. I'll be absolutely honest. I don't think the first flight was available, or the second flight was cheaper, or whatever it might have been, but we took the second flight.
Yeah. Okay. Sorry, someone else, and then maybe you at the front.
So can I just a comment on the images? I think I agree with this gentleman that we've seen similar issues, similar images over and over again. And as a member of Extinction Rebellion, I think it's a climate crisis, and that's why I'm not too bothered about offending people's sensibilities, because it is a crisis.
Yeah.
Having said that, an article that took up around my workplace the other day was with practical issues and practical measures of, if you fly to New York or you eat a kilo of steak or you do this or you do that, this is the kilogram squared of carbon dioxide. And people say, okay, I'm not flying this year, but I will have my steak.
Yeah.
So practical, personal things that they do.
Yeah. I think that's also what we sometimes come across, that people say when they see those pictures that it feels very overwhelming, and what can you do to actually help with that? And one of the recommendations we would give is if you use that imagery to make people maybe care or realize the extent of the problem, and to couple that with kind of practical actions of what people can do themselves to actually address that. So basically using both the problem and the solution narrative is probably what works best. And maybe what you were saying about climate risk as well, that's what we've seen also in the media, how some of the narrative changes. So we're not talking about climate change, but climate emergency. And so people are thinking about how can we use not just images, but language as well, to really bring across the message, and not feel that, or not that people feel, yeah, we all know that already, or it feels like something that is not relevant to them.
So we've got time for one more
question. Oh, sorry, yeah.
One more comment.
Yeah, I know.
Is this working? Yeah. Just to pick up on what the gentleman at the back said about, he sees all those images every day and becomes immune to them.
Yeah.
And I think one of the things is, sitting here in our little ivory tower that is Staple Inn, all of those images are on the other side of the world.
Mm-hmm.
If they were on our doorstep, we would not be becoming immune to them so easily.
Yeah. It's a bad thing to happen. But that we see it here as well. But yeah.
Okay, so I think my microphone, everyone can hear me. Our final section is around taking action. And actually, what we're going to talk about here is why this is going to become a bigger role for actuaries in the future, and actually why it might be a bit of a role for some of you now. So we have another quiz, or poll. It's not actually a quiz, no prizes here. Same link as before. We can switch over to the... Okay, I think we've got the results in. So actually, this is really interesting. For the vast majority, although it seems to be competing like a horse race there, it's not actually part of people's jobs. But this, I think, is really interesting. 20% is actually, it's a routine part of their job nowadays. Can you raise your hands if it's a part of your job? Okay, yeah, so it's quite a few people in the room. That's really interesting. And if it's been a one-off project, just a show of hands, yeah. Great, okay. So it feels to me that if we'd asked this question a year ago, that 20% would be kind of right down there. Can we switch back to the presentation, please? Okay, so this is really why it's becoming part of our job. First of all, the actuarial profession issued a risk alert in 2017 telling actuaries that actually we should be understanding climate change and communicating the extent that we take into account climate-related risk. I think when that came out, a lot of people were like, how? But I think kind of experience, tools, resources have been growing since that date. I won't go into this in too much detail, but I do want to flag that the actuarial profession has so many tools nowadays to help you think a little bit more about how you might apply climate change thinking into your role. I don't know if you've got anyone who was on the GI climate change resource committee thing. That they recently issued a practical guide for GI that's just out, but we've also got practical guides for pension and kind of around financial assumptions and demographic assumptions up there. So they're a good starting point. Perhaps the biggest driver and why this is becoming a larger role in many actuaries' life is to do with regulation. So earlier this year, four regulators, the FCA, the FRC, the TPR, which is the pension regulator, and the PRA, actually issued a joint statement saying, climate change, we think this is an important part of our supervisory mandate, and we think we should all kind of work together on this. So you can see how seriously they are taking it. And Mark Carney, the governor of the Bank of England, this is a huge passion of his. He is very concerned about systemic risk in the financial system caused by climate change. Now, I just want to flag the government's green finance strategy because this is fairly recently released. I think it was July. But it has a really good summary of the regulatory environment by different regulators and some of the initiatives that they've been involved in, and also the direction of travel. Just to flag a couple of things, it feels like banking and insurance sector might be becoming ahead because of the PRA's supervisory statement. They have set out expectations for banks and insurers around kind of disclosure of climate risks, climate governance, the need for scenario analysis to help you make strategic decisions. So it's definitely on the radar of those kind of institutions. If you're working for them, you'll probably know about it. The TPR has established a joint working group actually around climate risk disclosure. So again, changes are coming for pension schemes and potentially around disclosure. Which brings me on to the Task Force of Climate-Related Financial Disclosures. Just a show of hands, how many people have heard of the TCFD? Okay, so the majority of the room. Now, the TCFD is still a voluntary initiative, but some describe this as regulation by the back door. And the reason is, if a regulator says, oh, we think there should be some climate risk disclosure, we should think there should be a governance framework. Actually, the TCFD conveniently provides a practical way of how you might disclose your climate risks, split into, as you can see, governance, strategy, risk management, and metrics and targets. Strategy also includes scenario analysis. Another thing to flag, in the government's green finance strategy, they made a statement about expecting all listed companies and large asset owners, they wanted them to disclose in line with TCFD recommendations. I don't know how solid that intention was. I don't know if anyone in the audience has more details, but it seemed to be quite a strong statement. So we'll be seeing more of this in the future.
Whether it's locking yourself up in a container in front of an oil company's headquarters or parking a big blue boat in the middle of Oxford Circus, or perhaps you've seen her face somewhere. She's been the face of the student climate strike. Climate activism is clearly on the rise. Many organizations have adopted really innovative ways of holding companies, businesses, and governments accountable. So an example, just Climate Earth is a collection of lawyers and environmentalists that essentially use legal recourse to hold some of these companies accountable. A couple of months ago, they sent a kind of a complaint to the Financial Conduct Authority on three insurance companies for their failure to disclose climate risks in their annual reports. Now, some of these things can lead to regulatory fines or litigation as well. Unfriend coal is an interesting one. They've got a tagline that says, our best insurance is to keep fossil fuels in the ground. Their aim is to make coal and other fossil fuels uninsurable. Without insurance, new coal projects wouldn't get off the ground, and many existing coal projects would have to sort of phase out. You've got some of the other campaigns, etc. The divest movement, which encourages institutional investors and others to pull out their money from fossil fuels and perhaps invest it in renewable energy companies or clean or into sort of a cleaner future. Here's sort of a wide array of organizations and initiatives that provide a bunch of free tools and resources for people to help them sort of assess, manage, and understand many of these climate risks. There's the Actuaries Climate Index, which tracks the frequency of extreme weather-related events and the extent of sea level rise. You've got the Principles for Responsible Investment that are a list of sort of broad principles that define what responsible investment really is. Some of the other things, Carbon Tracker, we've got sort of the CDP as well. A lot of companies report on their emissions to the CDP. So if there's a company you want to check on and understand how they're responding to sort of the climate challenge, you can go on to CDP and try and search for the company as well.
And actually, I just wanted to flag a few that I use quite regularly when I'm trying to research a company. One is simply the TCFD. They have a list of their supporters, so you find out whether they support TCFD, shows you their general direction and thinking, and you can also then have a good guess about whether they disclose, so you can go and find their disclosures. Transition Pathway, a great resource for kind of more carbon-intensive, fossil fuel-heavy industries. They send out a questionnaire which companies send back, and it kind of ranks them of whether they're kind of ready for this transition or whether they don't even think climate change is a thing. And actually, Samir's already mentioned it, but CDP, you can't get their most recent reports unless you have a kind of special login, but you can get kind of the previous company's report. So again, quite a good resource just to find out how an organization is responding, whether that's for your own research so you can kind of copy their approach, or whether that is just so you kind of understand your clients or your own employer better.
Right, so now our last slide. What you can do, so hopefully we've given you some a good overview of some of the issues and some ways of approaching them and communicating them. So three things you can do: learn, talk, and act. Learning is all about understanding your responsibilities. That can be on a personal level, but also on a professional level, what you can do. Find out what your clients, employers, competitors are doing to respond to climate change, and see if these are things that you can be adopting as well, and maybe even develop your own toolkit. We said here to talk about your colleagues and clients, but I think it's also talking to your friends and just generally about climate change. I think it's quite a broad topic with lots of things happening, lots of initiatives happening. We saw lots of them just on the board now. So you can't know everything, but really by talking to people, you can learn quite a bit more. And you can also learn about adapting your message and testing out different things as well. And then challenging decision makers as well to adopt some of the things we just talked about, like the TCFD recommendations and good climate governance.
And then finally, we want you to also start acting on climate risks. So the kind of obvious one is to start considering the impact of climate risks on your assumptions, your calculations, and advice. Now, this will look completely different depending on whether you are kind of general insurance actuary specializing in kind of some sort of catastrophe, or whether you are an investment actuary. You'll have different tools, different approaches, and there are different levels of maturity. But look at the case studies that are out there. There is a growing body of work by different organizations that you can start to kind of learn from. One thing we talk an awful lot about quantifying. We need to put numbers on it. That's really important. I appreciate as an actuary, it's quite important for our jobs. But don't be afraid to start with a qualitative assessment, because actually that is so much more easier to communicate to your employers, to your clients, to your colleagues. So looking at what are the risks, what does that actually mean in terms of the business impact, and sourcing some evidence behind that. That's a really simple framework to look at risk in a qualitative way. Communicate, of course, what you've done, because it will evolve over time. It's okay to start from something simple and each year learn from it as you revisit it. And also, finally, consider taking part in any internal kind of initiatives that your organisation is doing. To be honest, if you're in a big assurer, you're in an asset manager, there are probably things going on and you can probably get involved. And consider some of the industry climate change initiatives. Go along to their events, meet people. And also, volunteer for the actuarial profession if an opportunity comes up and you're keen to find out more.
So, to wrap up, a final poll we'd like to run. Same link as before, so no change there. Go back on your browser. And respond to our final question.
So we're only asking you to do one small thing in the next 3 days. I think on the screen, I don't know what you can see on your phone, but basically is option one, explore some of the tools and resources in this presentation. Two, have a conversation with someone. C is do some research about your own organisation or your favourite clients. And then D is simply list the ways that you think climate risks or opportunities kind of impact your organisation or favourite clients. So I think, I don't know whether it's missing on your phone, but it's obviously missing on the screen. All right. What's that?
Great to see that A is so high, and I think we're going to share the slide.
Yeah, I think it'll be up on the website. Yeah,
hopefully.
Okay.
Is it on? Yeah, it's a question relating to, which you touched on a bit, with two related questions on transition risk. To what extent do you think current asset prices might be mispriced because of transition risk? And then related to that, the indifference, because we hear it so much, I wonder if you turn around and say there's opportunities because of this, and whether that's somewhat cynically to people a more way of getting people to act because they think there's opportunities rather than just lots of risks.
Mm, I think that's yours.
Yeah, I think there's... It probably depends on what kind of asset or industry you're looking at, but I think there is a big possibility that transition risks are being kind of mispriced, and actually climate risk generally is being mispriced. And the reason I say that is because there isn't actually enough information out there necessarily for investors to make the right decision, and that is the whole point of the TCFD. So by providing this extra information around how an organisation, you know, does it have good climate governance? Does it acknowledge what those risks are? Does it have a strategy? Unless you have that information, you won't know if they actually have a plan. So yeah, I think there is that's what Mark Carney is worried about, and you know, kind of shocked the system because of that. Just the second one was more around kind of flagging the opportunities and if that will engage people more. Personally, from experience, yeah, I think with a lot of audience, it can be quite exciting. And it's quite interesting, if you look at some of the investment funds that are kind of emerging now for pension schemes, you do have these ESG climate tilted ones, which just tilt away a little bit from kind of fossil fuels and kind of nasty, weapon producers. But actually, there are some new funds emerging which are more really around opportunity and impact, and I think that gets people a little bit more excited. I don't know if anyone else has any views on those two questions.
No. Thank you, John Bayliss, fellow. Don't have any particularly strong views on those two questions, apart from I feel like in these type of events, we tend to preach to converted, so most people around the room will already have an interest, and somehow we've got to get the message out. And yeah, this is a great kind of introductory way. I think the interactivity is really helpful. But somehow we need to get the message out. For instance, the 2017 risk alert, not sure how many people have actually read it in the profession. I think the answer is quite low. So a lot of things like that. And the other thing that was kind of missing in the action points at the end, I thought, was education. I do have a vested interest here, but the education run by the Institute and Faculty of Actuaries has very little coverage of anything to do with ESG, anything to do with stress testing on these type of risks that you've been raising, and a whole bunch of other things. So I think there's a need for that, and we need to spread the word.
And I absolutely agree with you on that point. I guess the one thing is, please do take these slides and use them to train your own colleagues and play with the interactive tools. Just take them and use them if you need to kind of educate and tell a story to people. So that's kind of one practical thing. I can't change the curriculum, but I think this point has been raised a few times, actually. But we'll keep raising it. And I guess the third point, you're right, we need to actually act. And I guess if any of us in any sort of decision-making power or can influence decision-makers, getting them to adopt something like TCFD or good climate governance. The WEF has a really good report out of how you would structure what that looks like. Something quite practical like that would be really useful.
I think sometimes it's also not about having the answers and trying to have all the facts ready to convince someone. Sometimes it can be just about asking the right questions as well. So when we talk about challenging decision makers and so on, it can be just about asking them, what are you doing? You don't necessarily need to educate them yourself, but it can be just about asking the right questions and getting people to think about it. Because sometimes also particularly people may get climate change and that it is a problem, that something needs to be done on a personal level, but sometimes making that connection to your job can be quite a different story, and actually integrating that in your job and seeing how your job links to that narrative as well. And so I think starting to challenge people to think about much more what they can do as part of their job is quite important as well.
Nick Spencer. I was just going to add to a couple points that came up during the quiz. Someone asked about the Climate Change Commission targets, and yes, it's based on production in this country. If we were to do it on consumption, we'd need to do 170%. So in some respects, those targets are only two-thirds what you might call fair. But as a point of hope, we also talked about net zero and the changes made. I think points made to different bodies are doing this. Already there's, I was talking to the UN the other day, there's already 70 bodies that are committing to net zero target, and there's going to push to increase that number as we come up to the Glasgow COP meeting next year in 2020. So there are things going on. Two resources I just want to flag. One is the PRI have an inevitable policy response. So for the people who don't think that this is going to affect them, I do encourage you to look at that paper and actually see the potential impacts. There's a ratchet thing, there's a stock take I referred to earlier in 2025, but look at the inevitable policy response at the PRI. And another, and if I'm plugging, those who are interested in the TCFD, the Institute of Actuaries and the PRI did a webinar yesterday that's on Bright Talk that you can also go and look up. So if you did PRI, IFOA and TCFD, Bright Talk, you can go look at that webinar. Great talks, particularly by Ben Carr at Aviva. Two final points. One, RNE has a board vacancy at the moment, so anyone interested in that, please apply. And even if you're not interested in board vacancy but would like to get involved in RNE issues, if you email Debbie Atkins, who's the membership secretary on the vacancy, and just ask her to notify you when RNE opportunities come up, that's a great way to get involved and to learn. And finally, to actually turn to my question, for the panelists. I think one of the areas that actually helps people in this is when they can get involved personally. Final resource for people in the room is a Cool Earth that actually would give two pages on individual actions that each of us can take, whether it's reducing the amount of fast fashion or flights or meat. But can I ask the panelists, is there something that they've done personally in terms of reducing their carbon footprint?
Thank you. Yeah. Well, how did you start them here?
Yeah, so I've sort of stopped eating red meat.
Same, I mean, I became a vegetarian as well, and I think much more mindful of kind of flying, even though it can't be avoided at all. Even though we have someone in the team who pledged not to fly anymore. So, but definitely seeking out of alternatives, so not just looking at flying, but also looking at trains and seeing that as an alternative, I think. Trying out different products, so just using soaps for your, as your shower gel or even as your shampoo. I think there are lots of sustainable solutions that are coming out at the moment, and not all will always work for everyone, but I think just trying one by one and making small changes and adjusting, I think, can be really good.
Yeah, and I'm also kind of trying out the usual suspects of eating less meat. I have tried to be a vegan, and I completely failed. I will keep trying. So eating a lot less meat and like having vegan breakfast, easy, quick hit. Offsetting my flights, and I am basically, if I can avoid flying, especially for work, I am not going to do it, because actually it's kind of miserable doing a 24-hour flight anyway. Actually, one, just to plug a resource, there's something called the Seat 61, I think it's called Seat 61, which is a great how do you travel around Europe on the train, so how do you get to kind of interesting places via the train. That's a great resource, and that's something that kind of we now use in my household. And finally, I am trying to buy more secondhand clothes because obviously fashion has a huge impact on the environment.
Thank you all for a really great presentation. It was very interesting, and obviously you can't cover everything. Can I put in a plea, though, for... Yeah, the actuarial profession, if it's anything, it's scientific, it's evidence-based, and it's quantitative. And I guess I'd be keen to have more of a discussion about the underlying science. We haven't really talked at all about why is there a link between carbon dioxide and change in temperatures and climate. And to try and make the arguments that we're looking at more evidence-based. So, yeah, there are lots of things which are talked about in the media and elsewhere as being the obvious things to do. Let's stop flying, let's all become vegans, let's close down coal-fired power stations in the UK, and let's have more wind. And quite probably all of those things are good. But the discussion should be on the evidence rather than everybody's talking about it, and so it seems like a good idea. And I do worry sometimes that there's a sort of flow of the debate, that things just become perceived wisdom. And I'd love to see the actuarial profession standing and saying, well, these things are good because they're evidence-based, but maybe some of these other things, well, let's look at the evidence and let's decide whether it's a good idea or not. So a plea, if I may, for more thinking about the evidence and less appeal to authority.
Well, that's interesting, because I would love a geek session around the science, where it comes from, and kind of uncertainty and the various parameters around that. So that's really interesting, and I'll kind of raise that with the RCPD subcommittee that I can't say the whole name because it's too long. In terms of the evidence-based response, actually, Kim, that is part of your job in terms of impact. You have to do quite a kind of evidence-based approach to your work. I don't know if it's worth brushing on that very briefly.
Yes, so often clients come to us because they need kind of the business case for doing a lot of the change or implementing new initiatives and whatnot. But what we often find is that it's still a lot about the story and how you talk about it, and actually not going too much into the detail. So what we often do is, obviously, the analysis we do is very much evidence-based. We think a lot about how we actually communicate that in a digestible way. So the clients I often use work with are not necessarily the kind of scientists
So, yeah, it's interesting to hear that there is an interest to learn more about it, and maybe because there's so much going on at the moment, maybe it intrigues people to actually understand more about the evidence behind it. So, yeah, that's really interesting. But we often try to do all the evidence and then try to communicate it in a bit of a lighter way and more, yeah.
Then people are responding based on the whether they make a sort of emotional connection to you and whether they, in some sense, trust you and treat you as an authority.
Mm.
And the danger, and there are many dangers, but what one danger of relying on somebody because they seem plausible rather than because you've understood the evidence is that you can end up believing anything. And, you know, we see this in all sorts of ways in the world today. Particularly as actuaries, I'd love to see us focusing more on actually understanding why we're taking particular actions rather than following because somebody else tells us it's a good idea. Sorry, I'm repeating myself.
I guess that comes back to reading your audience, and maybe that that is an audience where you are interested in getting into the nitty-gritty of all of that. So, yeah.
And had some technical difficulty tonight. Hopefully next month it'll be better. But thanks so much for coming and talking to us and sharing insights. I'm sure a lot of us will take that away with us, just for ourselves and then also, you know, to share within our teams. Thank you for your participation. You've been really, really good. We've got prizes for the best contribution. I think all of you contributed really well. I don't really know if we got any contribution from a student, but so I'm just going to hand it out to of the audience members who participated really well, and the gentleman over there in the suit, and the lady over there with the blonde bob hair, if you can come forward afterwards and collect. Well done, and thank you for contributing throughout the night. And then I know I saw some hands raised, though we have no more time for questions. So hopefully the speakers can stay afterwards, and then you can join us for some networking drinks and carry on the conversation. And then I'd just like to draw the meeting to the close in the usual way by thanking the speakers.
So the three winning teams should come up and pick up their prize as well. I'll send one in a post. I think it was maybe three, the maximum. Oh,